Okay, first of all, we want to welcome our guests. So, let's see, first and most importantly, we have Rav Shmuel Kagan, a very esteemed mechanech from South Africa, alumnus of the yeshiva, so it's really nice to have you with us, Rav Shmuel, as he's known. And we have a lot of guests coming, so you're welcome to another alumnus in the back, Lawrence Burian, who's visiting with his son today. And we have the Kozlovs from Philadelphia. Anyone else here that I'm not seeing or... Okay, and all of our studies, Okay, I'm going to use the opportunity today not just to discuss a person, but to discuss a part of our Masara that a lot of you are underexposed to, and underexposure always breeds ignorance, and ignorance always breeds stigmatization and prejudicial thought. We know very little about the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the modern Hasidus movement, Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer. And because we know so little about his life directly, I'll just give you some basic details. He wrote none of his Torah down. All that we know of him almost exclusively is based on the Torah that he taught his Talmidim. And I'll try to explain what are some of the four or five basic themes of Hasidus that he launched. Yisrael ben Eliezer was born, again, these are all these figures are very, very vague in general. 1698... around that period, more or less in the Ukraine, a town called Akupi in Ukraine. He's generally identified with another Ukrainian town that becomes the center of Hasidus called Mezhibuzh. Mezhibuzh, again, whether it's Ukraine or Poland, depends on what part of the 17th, 18th century you are you're gauging. And he dies in 1760 on the first day of Shavuos, on the second day of Shavuos. Great stories about his death that I'll try to share with you. What's important about his life, the details that we have that more or less set you up, is he's orphaned at a very, very early age. He's taken in by a family relative, and at least he's not the classic trajectory of these gedolim that we've shared with you. By the age of 5, he was seen as an eroi, and by the age of 10, everyone in town deferred to him, and he was seen as someone, at least in his younger years, who just wasn't cut for learning. He wasn't sitting in his... There's something different about him. So he ends up being someone who helps the children go to cheder. He calls them from their houses and brings them to the schools. And he gets involved in all these para activities. He learns shechita. He spends a lot of time in the fields meditating, learning nature, the remedies that are nascent within various plants. And a lot of a very, very different narrative than the classic. By the time he was 3, he knew Tanakh. By the time he was 10, he knew Shas, and he was already seen as the up-and-coming Gadol. He has an encounter, and this is going to sound strange because you're very trained to be empirical, and he doesn't operate in the empirical realm. He's a mystical. He has an encounter with Achia HaShiloni. Achia HaShiloni, who received Masaras from David HaMelech, and he encounters, and he basically passes on to Rabbi Yisrael mystical abilities, surrounding primarily writing amulets. Amulets contain the name of Hashem. So this is practice, remember. We'll talk about this a little bit later. Kabbalah isn't something that Baal Shem Tov inaugurates. Kabbalah exists from Har Sinai. You're not exposed to it, but most of the people that you're studying this year were Mekubalim. The Ramban was a Mekubal. The Rashba was a Mekubal. Rabbi Yosef Kairo was a Mekubal. It's almost more difficult to find Gedolim that we learn from who weren't Mekubalim than to find people who were Mekubalim. The Rama was a Mekubal. The Rambam wasn't, or Sajigon wasn't, but most of them were. So this Kabbalah is a strain of mystical thought, not empirical. You're all empiricists. You live in the modern world. So science can help me deconstruct this piece of paper into molecules, and I can understand how they bond with one another. But what's underneath the science? Why do they? But not what or how, but why? Where does it come from? Where does the science come from? That's where the scientist ends, his inquiry. Scientist never asks why. He just wants to know what. He deconstructs and studies the structure. So writing amulets to heal people, writing amulets to help people, so he becomes Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, who's able to write these names in a very effective way. That becomes his name, Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. He was instructed after this encounter to conceal his identity till he was 36. So again, in a very, very different track than people who are already getting to know him. He suffers a lot of poverty and ignominy because of that concealment, which becomes part of the core of the Hasidic movement, that it's Hasidus is an anti-establishment movement. It's a revolutionary movement. So a lot of Hasidus Rebbeim have to suffer being disparaged. The Babacher Rebbe, during these 51 days that we're now living through, climaxing in Yurtes Kislev, is in jail because Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon are questioning the value of Hasidus. So it becomes part of the Hasidic narrative. Well, if the Baal Shem Tov suffered poverty and suffered embarrassment and suffered injustice, that's what it's going to take in order to bring Gula to our people. And that's something that we're willing to submit ourselves and to subject ourselves to. There's a coronation that takes place once he's revealed. And again, he doesn't reveal himself frontally in a city called Breida, which is also in that area. And then all of a sudden, once people realize who he is, dozens and dozens of Talmid HaChamim flock to him. And he turns out to be, surprisingly, a baki in all halacha, gemara, chumash, and of course, devarim hanistarim, things that are spiritual and mystical. And then, of course, he starts to develop his name. Keep in mind, this is still a very, very difficult time, as I'll explain to you later, why it's such a difficult time in Jewish history. But part of the challenge was, while he is establishing himself as the Baal Shem Tov and building the movement of Hasidus, which has, thank God, become institutionalized and mainstream within Judaism, there are a lot of fakers around. There are a lot of fake Hasidus Rebbeim. So part of the challenge is, it's not just as a revolutionary movement and how should we accept this movement, but there are imposters, there are charlatans who are making their way through the countryside, selling snakeskin oil, passing themselves off as Hasidus Rebbeim. So that already becomes part of the challenge within the challenge. Finally, and something I'll come back to later, he migrates to Israel, as many of the original Hasidus Rebbeim did. This is a very redemptive movement, and redemption in many ways is anchored in the land of Israel. And he stalls in Istanbul, which in some cases is more important than reaching Eretz Yisrael, because what was the reason he stalled? He receives instructions from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he should return and build Hasidus in the Ukraine. So sometimes in Hasidus, it's more important to try to move to Eretz Yisrael, but to be sent back for the Hasidim who need your guidance and leadership, and to give up on that dream of moving to Eretz Yisrael, a dream which is deferred only a few dozens of years because his Talmidim are the first modern Zionists. He's pre-Zionism, you can't call them Zionists, but they're the first people to arrive in Eretz Yisrael en masse in the late 1800s, in the late 18th century, excuse me. There was a failed movement and migration in the early part of the 18th century around Yerushalayim, but this is the first successful Ashkenazi migration. Sephardim are moving in larger numbers, Ashkenazim are stalled in the 18th century. By the end of the 18th century, 300 of his Hasidim moved to Eretz Yisrael. When he dies on Shavuos, he says, I could have gone up to Shemayim like Eliyahu alive, but I decided to die for various reasons. People spoke about him. It's not a joke. These sound funny to you because you're trained in Western empiricism, rationalism, and your mind just can't grasp ideas that are beyond math equations or scientific proofs. There are ideas here that, and obviously they're part of our tradition, which they've fallen out, and only here should become a makubal, but to just disparage it because it's all hocus pocus and witchcraft is basically ignoring a major, major thrust of our Masara, which doesn't mean you should become a Kubbalim tomorrow, but to appreciate when people are speaking those terms, that I received a tradition from Achia Shiloni, who had a dream and went to Shemayim, is these, if you lived in the 1400s in Spain, in the 1700s in Poland, these would be obvious to you. Of course, you had a dream and you went to Shemayim because your world is much more pivoted based on a blend between rationalism and mysticism. We become hyper-rationalists, which is fine. That's how we have to proceed. I don't want to turn you into mystics, but it's simply anachronistic to look back and because I read the New York Times and I go to university, then all these things are bunk. It's just simply we're trained differently and our trajectories are just very different. Okay, let me talk a little bit more about Hasidus, because again, by definition, the details of his life are sketchy. By definition, it's because he's operating, I should say, under the radar. This is a revolutionary movement. He's not part of the mainstream. He's specifically not writing. This isn't a movement of erudition and scholarship. So things aren't being committed to text, and the details are very, very unknown. But what's happening? Well, what does Hasidus mean? What are the four or five ideas of Hasidus that he launches and then become, obviously, diversified based on the various forms and branches of Hasidus? Okay, the 1700s, the early 18th century, is probably one of the lowest periods in the Jewish Gullus. It's a very, very difficult period. 1666, Shabtai Tzvi announces himself as a Mashiach. Of course, close to a half of the Jewish population across the globe believes him, sells off their possessions, tries to migrate to Palestine, and then, of course, he's imprisoned by the Turks, and he confesses his commitment to Islam, and this leads to wide-scale depression across the Jewish nation. Not just depression, you can imagine there's nothing worse than dash expectations, but also aftershocks, because he was a mystic, he was also an antinomian. Antinomian is a fancy way of saying, now that we live in a redemptive era, we don't have to keep halacha. So he surrounds himself around the campfire with his followers, Shabtai Tzvi, and he eats pig, and he makes a bracha, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam matir isurim, as opposed to matir asurim, because now that's redemption, we don't necessarily have to keep mainstream halacha. So that's a fancy word for supplanting halacha based on the period of Geula. And there's a lot of aftershocks and movements that are still Sabbateanists. I was just speaking yesterday to one of our visitors who told me he's a descendant of Jonas and Eibeschitz, and he went to Tumim or something, and someone from Philadelphia, actually. And I said, well, I hope you won't meet a descendant of Yaakov Tzvi Emden. And those of you who aren't familiar, one of the great, great clashes of the 18th century, people accused of Jonas and Eibeschitz of being a Sabbateanist, as being one of these, what you may have been familiar, you learned in high school, the Frankist movement, which was a post-Sabbateanist movement of Kabbalah. And it's not just an intellectual challenge. It's also Poland is in disarray. The entire Polish kingdom is thrust into poverty. Jews are always at the bottom end of the food chain. They're suffering disproportionately. The Jews have been granted para-sovereignty under a council called the Va'ad Arba Aratzos. Has anyone ever heard of the Va'ad Arba Aratzos? That has been dismantled. It's a very, very difficult time. The Gullus is darkening. It's a very difficult, it's a tremendous split between those who learn Torah, who find meaning in Talmud Torah, and those who are ignorant. There's no educational system erected to incorporate those people who can't learn at the highest levels. It's a very, very dark period in history. And from this period, Chassidus swells and tries to bring hope. That's a cliche. You'll hear this cliche. Chassidus brought hope back to Judaism. What does that mean? What did it start? What were four or five of its revolutionary ideas as proposed by Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov? Again, the most direct record we have are two svarim. One sefer is called Shivchei HaBesht. Nothing he wrote. Shivchei HaBesht is a collection of his sayings, the nice statements of the Besht, and Baal Shem Tov or Keser Shem Tov Ala Torah. Nothing he wrote. And of course, all of his Talmidim, and the Talmidim of his Talmidim, and the Talmidim of his Talmidim, are quoting him. So any of the latter Chassidus Svarim, you'll have quotations of what the Baal Shem Tov said, wrote, or quite frankly, did. Stories, miracles, parables. So he's changing the genre a little bit as well. It's not just his Chiddush from Bava Kamma. In fact, we don't have any Chiddush in Bava Kamma. It's not what he was involved in. He was involved in a very, very different sphere of intellectual activity. Let me try to break it down into five. Okay? Number one, when you're living through a galus that seems unending and infinite and dark and depressing, so how do you resolve it? You resolve it by informing people that galus isn't interminable. Wherever you live, how difficult the experience is, there's going to be a geula. Now, every Jew lives with a hint of geula, right? Afal pi shi yismameach. But classic Judaism is passively waiting for geula. When I say passively waiting, I don't just mean passive, just sitting in a corner. You're performing mitzvahs and Torah. They all aggregate to advance geula. But you don't directly trigger geula. Your mitzvahs and your Torah create zechuyos, and Shemayim HaKadosh Baruch Hu calculates how many zechuyos the Jewish people do or don't have, and that will advance geula. Kabbalah, not just Chassidus. Kabbalah predates Chassidus. Ria Kadosh was involved in the Kabbalah of Yosef Kai. Kabbalah says the man could be more active in advancing geula. So, for example, in Kabbalah, people would get up in the middle of the night and daven. What do we call that? Davening, tikkun, chatzos, to wail for the galus and to try to advance geula. So what do you do at 12 o'clock at night? You get up and cry for our galus and try to accelerate geula. So Chassidus takes Kabbalah, and I don't have enough time today to demonstrate how Chassidus changed Kabbalah. Maybe I'll mention a little bit later. And saw man as being much more active in geula. Now, how are you active in geula? So for us, geula is pivoted geographically and historically. Namely, galus means we failed, whether it's man failed morally in Gan Eden, or the Jewish people who established paradise in Eretz Israel, Gan Eden, failed nationally. We were evicted from Gan Eden. We were evicted from the Beis HaMikdash from Eretz Israel. And our entire narrative, our entire desire, is to retrace those steps back to Geula, geographically and nationally. But Kabbalah studies something very, very different. Kabbalah studies the fall of the cosmos. Forget Earth, forget Israel, forget HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in his infinite presence, created a world. And that world was incapable of containing his infinities. Anyone know what that incapability is called in Kabbalah? Shaviras HaKelim. The receptors that Hashem had intended to contain his infinite sweep were incapable of containing that. So the world was plunged into a fallen state. Now, fallen state, by the way, is not a moral issue, which is simply a world of HaKadosh Baruch Hu being undivided. Hashem is indivisible. You can't break him into parts. Well, our world is divided. Molecules, atoms, people, conscious, subconscious, color, differences, senses. Your senses are all divided. That's not a reflection of Hashem. Our world is very, very different from the Ribono Shel Olam because we're all divided. How do you take a world that's divided and shape it in a way that reflects Hashem's indivisibility? That's called Yichud HaOlam. That's why Hasidim, who participate in Kabbalah, will precede many of their mitzvos by saying, L'shem Yichud Kutcha Brichu Shchinte. Many of you may say it for Sviras Omer because somehow it wormed its way into this regular Machzarim for Sviras Omer. I don't because I'm not a Chassid. And I'm consistent. So I don't say the Shem Yichud when I take Lulav. I don't say the Shem Yichud when I eat matzah. I don't say the Shem Yichud when I say Sviras Omer. Not because I'm opposed to it, because it's not what I practice. I don't practice Kabbalah actively. I think about it, but I don't practice it. Somehow, Sviras Omer, which is highly Kabbalistic because of the 7x7 lattice, so it became very, very popular to say the Shem Yichud Kuchibrechu for Sviras Omer. So I can change the world and I can be involved in Geula. Here's a real irony. I spoke about this morning. Not only even if I'm in Poland, but some ways even better if I'm in Poland. Because Geula isn't geographical, Geula isn't national, Geula isn't historical, Geula is cosmological. I'm trying to change the entire universe, the entire cosmos. And I may have more access being in Poland than I may have access being in Israel, because I'm with Gentiles, and we'll talk about this a little bit later. So, for example, because you're involved in a larger redemptive experience, so if you went over to a chassid and he'd be davening shacharis at 11:30 in the morning, and you'd start snickering and saying, shacharis, 11:30 in the morning, it's after Zman Tefillah. He may not respond to you, he'd be too, more respectful, he would just continue his davening, but he may be thinking, what does that mean, 11:30 in Johannesburg? But I'm not really thinking about Johannesburg. I'm thinking about the cosmos, and I'm beyond time. What does time mean if you're on a different planet? And like, what do you mean? Oh, you're shackled by time. You can't think about the cosmos. You're just thinking about Johannesburg. So for you, it's 11:30. But I'm trying to take a cosmo. Now, how do you view the halacha? Halacha tells us to act halacha. And that's why the Vilna Gaon... Right, and that's why the Vilna Gaon... They have an answer. I'm just trying to open your mind. They won't just say, oh, we don't care about Zman Tefillah. It's because they have an agenda that transcends time and transcends place. So part of it was broadening Geula, not just to history and to geography, but broadening Geula to cosmology, it's called, as well as internalizing Geula. So one of the most famous of thousands of famous statements of the Baal Shem Tov was, and I'll read it to you because it's quoted by one of his Talmidim, each person has to change the layers of Mashiach within his neshama. Shetzarech kol achad b'Yisrael letaken ulahachin chelek komas Mashiach hashayach l'neshmaso. If you're interested, a fancy way to call that, it's called internalization of Geula. And this becomes very, very prominent in Chabad. This becomes very, very prominent in Lubavitch, where each part of the human psyche correlates to another part of the universe. And instead of looking outwards, you look inwards, understand yourself, redeem yourself, and that will lead to redemption. So redemption is switch. For us, redemption is national, historical, geographic. For the Baal Shem Tov, it becomes. So that's one way to deal with the Gullus. The second way to deal with the Gullus, again, commonly misunderstood, but extremely important. Avodas Hashem, please listen to me, is a blend of two traits. You relate to Hashem in two ways. You love Him and you fear Him. Love doesn't mean love. Fear doesn't mean fear. You're not afraid of Hashem. That's schoolboy fear. Fear means you don't understand Him and you accept the fact that He's a mystery. You accept the fact that He's a higher will and you can't understand and penetrate that world. That's called Yirat Shamayim. When does Avram achieve Yirat Shamayim? After the Akedah. The Akedah demands of him an action he can't understand morally. Ata yadati ki yirei elokim ata. Avas Hashem means you understand him and you see religion as ennobling to the human condition, so you love him because it serves human interests. So when I perform a chesed, when I celebrate Shavuos, when I get together on Shabbos, say, this is great. What would my Shabbos be like if I were running around 7 days in the week? What would my life be like if I didn't have compassion for poor people? What would my life be like if I didn't have family in Dinei Nida? So when religion stacks up and overlays life, I love Hashem because he changed my life for the better. When religion deviates from my interest, then I fear I just have to accept you. I can't understand your HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, those are very, very delicate pistons that are meant to be very, very delicately calibrated. After living in exile for 1,600 years, being persecuted, expelled, burned at the auto de face, persecuted, discriminated, which of these two emotions towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu do you think starts to dominate? I love you because I understand you, or I accept the mystery because I don't understand you? Accept the mystery. Yirat Shamayim starts to dominate the Jewish landscape because too much suffering, too much Kiddush Hashem, too much death, too much persecution. So Jew just says, I don't understand you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but I serve you. Hasidus tried to restore Avas Hashem and Simcha. That's what they mean. It's not that let's take some drugs and some alcohol and dance because we want to be artificially happy. To the outsider, it appears that way. To the insider, it's an attempt to rebuild an intimacy with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the darkness of Galus, to feel that closeness with the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, and to restore that love and that appreciation of religion rather than just accepting his will because it's his will, and I submit. It's a very, very delicate shift. It's a restoration of simcha within this very delicate fusion of simcha and acceptance. And that simcha is based on an intimacy between a human being and a Kadosh Baruch Hu that, quite frankly, 1,500 years of exile had completely, completely eviscerated. It was hard to feel intimate with Hashem when all you spent, well, your entire Jewish history is marked by suffering and depression. So that's one major, major shift of Hasidus. I'd call it how to deal with Galus. It's a response to Galus. Hasidus has to emerge within one of the lowest points in Galus because it offers people tools to respond. Avas Hashem, activist redemption, shifting redemption from national and geographic arcs into personal or cosmological arcs. Number two, integration. Okay, Judaism had become compartmentalized. When you're holding a lulav, you're acting religiously. When you're learning the Beis Medrash, you're acting religiously. When you're davening, you're acting religiously. What about when you're in the market? What about when you are just day-to-day activities? Of course, you're not speaking Lashon Hara. Of course, your eyes aren't wandering, but that's just abstention. So essentially, there's a cellularization between when I'm religious and when I'm neutral, just staving off religious peril. And as we speak about so much, you may be intrigued to hear a lot of our ideas nascent within the way I'm describing Hasidus. That's why Hasidus has become so popular, because it has shaped our identity. What are we trying to convince you of here in Yeshiva? Shavisa Hashem Lenegdi Samid. And everything you're involved in is a religious activity. And it's that type of integration which the Baal Shem Tov thrust, or the Baal Shem Tov asserted. So let me just quote for you, just so you should know some of the names associated with the Baal Shem Tov. Let me quote for you his Talmud. His primary Talmud was Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Anyone know someone named Yaakov Yosef? It's a very popular name in the Hasidic families. Oh, his name is, they're very mocked, they call Yaakov Yosef, the double name. So his name was Yaakov Yosef. He wrote the first written sefer. I happen to own it. Not his first sefer. I happen to own a copy. To be honest, I can't read it. I mean, I try here and there. It's high, high, high Kabbalah. Really high Kabbalah. You really need to know your Kabbalah well, which I don't. So I can read more diluted forms of Hasidus, which is the mainstream books. They know Melech Melech, the Tanya. But this is Kabbalah that, let's say, a 16th century Kabbalist in Tzfat would have an easy time reading through because he knows the terms. So the Toldos Yaakov Yosef on Parshas Vayetze said that a Jew should be a Sulam Mutzav Arza Veroshah Magiha Shamayim. He should be a bridge between the physical, material world and the spiritual world, but he should also affect, and this is an empowering aspect of Hasidus. You're not just bridging the two worlds, but remember, the top of the ladder has an impact upon the area that it rests upon. So through your activities, you can affect the world around you, and every activity has deep, resonant religious meaning. So for example, you're gonna snicker at this, but listen carefully. Try to put your prejudice aside. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef once said, I wish that I had the same type of religious impact of unifying Hashem's presence in this world when I learned Torah and Daven that the Baal Shem Tov had when he smoked his pipe. To us, we'd say, that's asinine. You're performing a mitzvah, and he's smoking his pipe. And so he was smoking his pipe. He was trying to uncover the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this world, and with his thought, it didn't make a difference. It's a very, very cerebral activity. It didn't make a difference what the externals, and I'll get to this in a moment, didn't make a difference what the externals were. He could find the inner core of Hashem's presence and create religious meaning. Which brings us to the third and related aspect. Okay, remember I talked about Hashem wanted to pour His presence into this world. The world wasn't capable of maintaining Hashem's infinite presence, so it scattered. Well, Hashem's presence scattered into the Beis Medrash in Yeshivat Har Etzion, into the Mizrahi campus in South Africa, in Johannesburg, into Kohelet, just trying to make our guests feel welcome. But Hashem's presence also scattered to many dark places. And they may seem evil, negative, toxic, but they're discovered. But Hashem's presence, by definition, is everywhere because He's infinite. Anyone know what we call the covering of Hashem's sparks? What's that word in Hebrew or Chassidus? These are all synonyms, but they're called a klipa. Klipa is a shell. And therefore, Hashem's presence is everywhere. You just have to find the inner core. Also, Parshas Vayetzeh. Everything in Tanakh becomes iconic and symbolic. Remove the stone. Remember, Yaakov removes the stone from the well. Remove the shell. Find the core. So, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence can be felt in Torah or davening, also be felt in smoking a pipe, or even in dark places. When Yaakov, I spoke about this morning in the Sfasem Mashir, Yaakov goes willingly into Golos, or even in the world of sin. It all has Hashem's presence. Now here is what makes this such an important concept. Because these two factors, A, integration, B, presence of Hashem concealed everywhere, allows Hasidus to be a democratizing movement. Remember I spoke before about how Judaism was very, very stilted and bifurcated, those who could learn, those who couldn't learn. Hasidus is a populist movement. And it tries to offer religious meaning to the non-learners. And this is what really creates the tension. Because if you can't learn, then do shechita with the right kavanah. That's why Chassidim is so much doing shechita. Or clean the mikvah with the right kavanah. Or in theory, smoke your pipe with the right kavanah. Or in theory, involve yourself in the marketplace with the right kavanah. Because you're just trying to serve Hashem, cling to Hashem, unify Hashem's presence. So there's a blurring of lines. Integration blurs lines. Hashem's presence is everywhere. And when those lines get blurred, Torah, Talmud Torah becomes decentralized. You could be just as accomplished in all your areas. So here's the yin and the yang of Hasidus, and here's the yin. We want Torah to be central. We don't want Torah to be claustrophobic. We want Torah to be monumental. We don't want it to be dismissive of people that know. This is at the core of Talmud Torah Connected Kul, at the core of yesterday Shir Kulei, Talmud or Maisa, which is more significant. And Hasidus tries to recalibrate some of that balance. But that's why people are so ignited and so enthusiastic about it. I can't learn. But I can serve Hashem in many other ways in my day-to-day experience, in my day-to-day thought. I can bring Hashem's presence to the fore, even in ways that don't seem to be externally religious. So this is two and three. Number one is how you respond to Golus. Number two is, do you integrate the two regions of your life? Number three, is there good and bad, or there's just Hashem's presence, and you have to uncover the core of HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shechina, no matter where you may, no matter what area you may be visiting. Number four and five, okay? Number four. So, for example, just I know we're a little bit further, but I'll try to be brief. The classic response to Machshava Zaros. Let's say you're davening and you have an evil thought. So I talked in one of the shiurim early this week about dismissing. You have to know how to emotionally dismiss a thought that passes through your mind. You can't be punished for a thought that passes through your mind, but you have to learn how not to indulge in it and to dismiss it, to get it out of your mind. in Chassidus, the trick became not to dismiss foreign thoughts, but to elevate them, because even a foreign thought has the presence of Hashem. So you would admit the foreign thought into your heart and then try to be ma'ala the machshava zara. So it's a complete shift of how people have been accustomed to working out their religious experience in avodas Hashem. Number four, avas Yisrael. Another phrase that's typically associated with Chassidus. You don't sense it so much because modern-day Chassidus has become very reclusive in the aftermath of the Holocaust. The Holocaust affected Chassidus disproportionate to how it affected the rest of the Jewish world. Most of Chassidus, based on the Holocaust and the fear of Zionism, are in a current state of insularity, in a current state of defensiveness. The outside world is dangerous, whether that's the outside world of Hitler, Yimach Shemo, or the outside world of secularism, and we will bunker down, fortress ourselves through dress, language, and cultural mores, and keep the dangerous world at bay. That's not the true Chassidus. The true Chassidus, which you only see today in Chabad, the true Chassidus is, how can we carve out a space for a Jew who isn't religiously loyal? Classically, someone who isn't religiously loyal, a non-religious or non-practicing religious Jew, they're outside of the community. We rebuke him. We always hold the door open. Chassidus says every single Jew has an immutable part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in them. When they sin, it's only extrinsic and casual, incidental. It's not existential. And even as a sinner, they still have an unparalleled level of Kedusha and Hashem's presence. And you see that in Chabad. Chabad basically embraces every Jew, regardless of how they perform and where they perform. And that's what it's built on. It's built on a very, very deep Hasidic idea of incorporating the other. Does this resonate with anyone in this room? If someone asks you, okay, be honest, why do you believe in Zionism? Isn't it secular? You're a religious Jew. Religion is more important than anything in your world. How could you partner with secular Zionists? You hear that question? If you haven't, it's because you're just simplifying your experience, shooting arrows and drawing targets. Assuming you hit the bullseye just because it's your arrow. What do you mean? Secular movement. Part of our answer is that modern Zionism, secular nationalism, has created a meaningful role for Jews, even though they're not classically religious. Living in Israel, serving in the army, feeling national pride, living their history. How many times have you met a cab driver who knows Tanakh better than you? Or a falafel salesman who has a picture of the Baba Sali and the Baba Terebi in his store. Doesn't put on tefillin, or doesn't keep Taras HaMishpacha, but they're deep, deep-hearted Jews. And they're living Jewish destiny and Jewish future as the other. Not fully. We would want them to wear tefillin. We'd want them to wear yarmulke. We'd want them, but they're still us. And they're still... That comes from Chassidus. That's a revolution of Chassidus. It was never thought of before Chassidus. Another Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov once said, I wish every Jew would kiss the Torah with as much Ava as the Baal Shem Tov used to kiss the hands of the little children he brought to school when he was helping them get to school. That's the story. The story that's told about how much Ava he saw. He kissed the hands of these little children with more Ava than people typically afford a Sefer Torah. I'll just mention one final aspect because we really are out of time. There's also great emphasis on letters. So in Chassidus, letters, gematria, shape of letters, deconstructing the architecture of letters. Letters are expressors. So much of Chassidus thinks about how to express Hashem's infinity into a world of finitude. That's Kabbalah. Letters are unifiers. You take parts and you create a letter. You take letters and you create a word. So if I'm a Chassid, remember Kabbalah was typically very elitist. You have to be really smart to study Kabbalah. Now Chassidus tries to create Kabbalah for the common man. So I can't understand cosmos. I'm a simple person. So your Rebbe would tell you, you see that word Avraham? Think about how the Aleph combines with the Beis, combining with the Resh, combining with the Hey, combining with the Mem. You see how you took letters and made a word? Separate entities that fused into one? Now think about Hashem's presence similarly fusing into one indivisible reality. And that's how you will be a partner or an activist in creating Hashem's fusion in this world. Take the different letters and make them into one word. So letters become, especially the letter Aleph, because Aleph stands for Or, and Or is the most infinite image we can imagine because it just radiates infinitely. So we'll try to think of Hashem's infinity, Or the Or Elyon, the infinite light. So that's why when you read Chassidus, this letter, that letter, the tzaddik, just to give you an example, okay? What does a tzaddik look like? A bent over nun with a yud on top. So if I were to draw a tzaddik, a bent over nun with a yud on top. So that suggests that the tzaddik bends himself down to accept HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. So letters become very, very symbolic. Words become symbolic. A lot in Chassidus that we typically, we see letters and words as portals to meaning. What does the word say? What's the content behind it? I don't care what the letters are. I don't know what it means. And in Chassidus, there's a lot of studying of what the letters are. So I'm not saying you're all going to go out and become Chassidus. I'm not even saying that you're going to all of a sudden study and have it influence your life, although for many of you, it's a nice idea. I think in our world, let me put it to you this way, okay? Someone told me, I'm not in that world, but someone told me that somewhere in the Lakewood world, one of the Gedolim got up a few months ago and announced, the Mussar period has ended. This great revolution called Mussar that was started also around that time, early 18th century, he feels in the modern world, it's just not doing it. It's not having it. He's talking to his community. And now he said in as many words, he didn't call it Chassidus, but he said, now people have to start learning Chassidus. Now you're seeing that. You're seeing a recovery. Something about our modern world has gone dry. Something about our modern world, the classic roles and the classic sources for inspiration somehow are less effective, and a lot of people turn to Chassidus. So if you feel you want to learn a little bit more about it, here's a great opportunity. But at the very least, you should realize there's a deep world out there. You're not seeing its real reflection. You're seeing a very, very pared-down form of it, but it's based on deep traditions of Kabbalah, and just understand that it's a world that, first of all, of deep ideas, not just dancing and singing and artificial spontaneity, but of really, really deep intellectual ideas, and ways that really influence how we think about redemption, how we think about integration of religion, how we think about people who aren't religious, but we want to try to include them. You probably heard that word before, right? Inclusive communities of inclusion. Right? Next time you hear it, say, oh, you must be a chassid. Next time you hear your principal discussing a community of inclusion, you say, oh, you must be a Talmud of Baal Shem Tov. You're talking about inclusion, or else you probably won't come to it. Okay?